I'd just like to remind everybody before we continue that each installment in this series builds upon the ones previous. So if you haven't checked out When Did Rome Fall and When Beast Met Serpent, I strongly suggest you do so before continuing with this one. But to review, first we looked at the history and features of the kingdoms represented in the image of Daniel 4, and we saw how Rome still thrives in modern Western culture, along with all the other kingdoms represented in the image. Then we covered the Jesuit order and explored how it's been a hotbed of Talmudic Pharisee influence ever since it began in 1534. Now, it's important we keep these things in mind as we go on, because if we understand them, it'll give us the proper perspective. Many folks ignore these points. And when they ignore these points, they end up swallowing the leaven of the Pharisees. Don't let that happen to you. The purpose of these videos is to inform you so you can be armed against falsehoods. There's a saying that those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it, and many of our people have neglected the lessons and examples given to us throughout history. So they've fallen victim to traps that they might have otherwise avoided. In this case, while some have seen Rome as an adversary and turned a blind eye to the Pharisees, others have focused on the Pharisees and turned a blind eye to Rome. To put this in perspective, if David had killed the lion but ignored the bear, the sheep still would have gotten eaten. It wouldn't have mattered that he'd killed the lion. We can't combat the lies of one enemy and allow the other to go unchallenged. We might as well not be standing up at all in that case. We need to see the whole picture. So I want to make abundantly clear that both Rome and the Pharisees are enemies to the kingdom of Christ in the present day, and they are closely allied with each other. In fact, I think it's safe to say that Rome has been taken over entirely by the Pharisees, as I touched on in the previous installment. Now let's get back into the history. Previously, I talked a little bit about the Counter-Reformation, which was the Roman Catholic Church's movement to beat back the teachings of the Reformation. Jesuits were very much involved in the Counter-Reformation. Just like today, Jesuits focused largely on teaching things such as theology. So you ended up with many Jesuit teachers springing up with sermons and writings to meet the flood of Protestantism coming out of Germany and France and Switzerland and so forth. This wasn't just a matter of mild disagreement over doctrine. Remember this. Rome was in serious danger. If Protestantism eroded away Rome's power base, Rome was ruined. And thus, so would be the conversos who piggybacked off of Rome. For both Rome and the Jews, this was very much a matter of survival. Now, nearly to a man, the great reformers of the day were pointing to Rome as the source of tyranny, as the source of false doctrine. Whether rightly or wrongly, the reformers tagged Rome as the beast of Revelation 13 or as the harlot of Revelation 17 and 18. They called the office of the Pope the Antichrist and identified it as the little horn which spoke great blasphemies in Daniel 8. So, with the Reformation being popular as it was, a lot of negative attention was being directed at Rome, and it was growing daily. Of course, the violent persecution certainly didn't help Rome's image, but apparently that was all Rome really knew to do in these situations. Regardless, Protestant eschatology needed to be shut down from their perspective, and the best way to do that would be to present different opposing doctrines to the table, kind of muddy the waters a bit at least, but ultimately take the heat off Rome. So two Jesuits rose to that challenge. The first was a Spanish priest, and his name was Francisco Ribera. In 1590, he published a 500-page commentary on the Book of Revelation, and he used this book to introduce the concept known as futurism. And it's on futurism that most modern dispensational theology is based. We could probably consider him the progenitor of the C.I. Schofields and Hal Lindseys and Tim LaHayes of our day. He pointed way off into the distant future and said a single-man Antichrist would one day come onto the world stage. Basically, he was the first to introduce the Antichrist individual most evangelical Christians today think is right around the corner. The second guy was also a Jesuit priest, and his name was Luis del Alcazar. In 1614, he published a massive 900-page commentary of his own on Revelation, only his approach was the exact opposite of Ribera's. He said all the events of Daniel and Revelation, with a few exceptions, had been fulfilled. And he wasn't the first to propose the idea, but he was certainly the first to formally put it together and lay it out extensively. And his view is what became known as preterism. Now, while neither of these eschatological views really gained much popularity at first, they eventually took off around the 1800s, give or take. All the same, for the better part of the first 200 or 300 years after 1500 or 1600, they were thorns in the sides of the reformers and subsequent teachers who believed Daniel and Revelation had current real-time application. Fast forward to today. The two main opposing views of futurism and preterism reign supreme in the arena of prophetic interpretation. Usually folks of the Reformed persuasion, such as Presbyterians, have gone for preterism, while most evangelicals and fundamentalists have embraced futurism, of course known today as dispensationalism. However different they may have been, though, both these viewpoints served the same purpose quite well as we can observe today. Both drew attention away from Rome. They turned people's eyes toward the future through futurism and to the past through preterism. Both leave people arguing between the two standard interpretational methods and keep them from the truth. And since truth is power, the two bickering schools of thought keep their adherents powerless. The Jewish socialist activist Noam Chomsky once said, "The smart way to keep people passive and obedient is to strictly limit the spectrum of acceptable opinion, but allow very lively debate within that spectrum." Now, when both sides of a dialectic come from the same source, and that source has a historical record of opposition to the kingdom of God, you'd think it would be wise to at least eye them with suspicion, right? False dialectics exist in our world in a variety of forms. For example, liberals versus conservatives, capitalists versus communists, Democrats versus Republicans, and so on and so on. We keep debating within these well-worn established ruts, and in each case, it seems we continue to spiral toward the worst rather than ascending to the better. And that's because if our enemies convince us that there are only two real schools of thought, which they provide for us, we'll keep spinning our wheels and squabbling among ourselves while they blithely go about their nefarious business without any real opposition. It's kind of like when the Midianites started fighting each other in Judges 7. They did a lot of the Israelites' work for them. Our enemies would love for us to do the same thing. They have always tried to turn us on each other, make us break fellowship over foolishness, and leave us divided and weak so they can swoop in for the spoils. Jesus told us in Matthew 16:6, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees." When you see two members of an order of the Pharisees lay the groundwork for two major opposing dialectical schools of thought in biblical interpretation, alarm bells should be going off in our minds. We should not ignore this. As I mentioned in a previous installment, our enemies knew Christian Israel believers would almost never swallow the futurist dispensationalist view of Daniel and Revelation. But hey, no big deal. We sheep love to swing the pendulum of reason all the way to the opposite extreme. If they discover futurism is false, then just convince the dumb goyim of preterism. Piece of cake. If nothing else can convince us of the effectiveness of this plot, just look at history again. Protestantism was roaring across the West, despite Rome's best efforts, and it seemed unstoppable. It utterly changed the face of civilization. But gradually, right along with the growing influence of both futurism and preterism, the influence of great biblical scholars and their movements petered out, stalled, and died. Now, today, what passes for Protestantism can accurately be called Catholicism Light. Hey, why not? They gladly call themselves Judeo-Christianity, don't they? The effects of both these viewpoints, futurism and preterism, are devastating. One, they distract us from our current enemy and the earthly kingdom which now exists, namely Pharisaism and Rome. Two, they distract us from what God is telling us about the present and lead us to apply it to the distant past or the distant future. Three, they disarm us and leave us vulnerable. Even if you think you're well-armed, you're actually armed with false information. Four, they create schisms within the body, and schisms also make us weak and vulnerable. Most recently, someone tried to say anyone who doesn't believe Christ didn't return in the flesh at the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD is an unsaved antichrist. I have a hard time imagining someone could say something so ludicrous unless they were deliberately being schismatic. Paul was dealing with this same exact problem in his day. Preterists will say, Alcazar didn't invent preterist theology, it was taught before him. And you know what? I agree. It was taught before Alcazar. Paul wrote in 2 Timothy 2, verses 16 through 18, "But shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness, and their word will eat as doth a canker," or cancer, "of whom is Hymenaeus and Philetus, who concerning the truth have erred, saying that the resurrection is past already, and overthrow the faith of some." Fanatical preterists today teach exactly what Hymenaeus and Philetus taught, that the resurrection, the most foundational hope for Christians throughout the centuries, is past. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul goes to great lengths to tie Christ's resurrection with our own. If Christ is raised from the dead, we will be too. But the preterist claims, we may have missed the resurrection, but hey, we'll get to go to heaven when we die. In this case, the person who's been persuaded by the preterists suffers overthrow of his faith. Repeatedly, the Bible teaches us that we will be resurrected and inherit the earth from beginning to end. It nowhere teaches that we will be taken to heaven. Going to heaven is a teaching carried over from Babylonian Zoroastrianism and from Gnosticism. So the fanatical preterist finds himself abandoning the Word of God and instead relying on the false promises of false prophets, of false religions, in order to make his eschatology work at all. And the Christian who has previously banked on the promise of resurrection is told, "Nope, sorry buddy, you missed the resurrection. That's not for you." So the rug is pulled out from under him and his faith is overthrown. He is a man most miserable. Once people have been convinced that the image of Daniel 2 no longer exists, they'll fall prey to it much more easily. If I'm in the woods and someone convinces me there are no wolves around, I'll take no precautions against wolves. As a result, when wolves show up, I'll be vulnerable to them and they'll eat me alive. In the case of convincing people the governments represented in Nebuchadnezzar's dream don't exist, it's like convincing people on a tossing ship that the ocean has dried up. It's so painfully obvious that the ocean is there, and yet there people are, convinced it's gone, despite getting seasick and being swept overboard. They're caught up in Babylonian economics, surrounded by Persian multiculturalism, swayed by Greek philosophy, beat up by Roman politics, and the whole time they're closing their eyes, covering their ears, and screaming that the image doesn't exist. In any battle, it is essential to know your enemy. But you won't know your enemy if you're convinced the enemy doesn't exist at all. You won't even prepare for battle. And if you do prepare for a battle, you'll be poorly prepared. You might as well bring a rickety biplane to a dogfight with an F-15. What was sown into Christian theology through futurism and preterism did exactly what it was meant to do. The Pharisees are an inherently clever and calculating bunch, and Christian Israelites are an inherently gullible and silly bunch. The fruits of preterism and futurism speak for themselves. Not one of the great men who defied the power of Rome and the Pharisees, not one of the great men who swayed Europe to stand up against the papacy, not one of the great men who led people away from the priesthood and back to the Bible was either futurist or preterist. Indeed, not one futurist or preterist has even made an accurate prediction, at least not without moving a lot of goalposts. The followers of Ribera and Alcazar will not change the world, not for the better. They never have, they never will. They pose no threat to the enemy because they don't know the enemy. In fact, I would go so far as to say that neither the futurist nor the preterist even understands the point of the gospel, which I hope to discuss in the next installment of this series. If you don't understand the point of the gospel, you can't properly follow it or be effective in the kingdom. As I demonstrated when I pointed out how the effect of the Reformation died with the growth of futurism and preterism. The leaven of the Jesuit Pharisees has not ceased to be a problem in the modern era. We're still haunted by the ghosts of the Riberas and Alcazars of the past. And by the way, and I don't know if there's anything to it, but isn't it interesting how the name Alcazar sounds an awful lot like a Spanish rendition of it? Alcazar? Those of you who know the history of the Khazars will get where I'm going with this. Those of you who don't may benefit from Benjamin Friedman's Facts Are Facts, which I mentioned in my last installment, or from Arthur Koestler's book, The 13th Tribe. As a final disclaimer, I am not putting this out with the intent to cause trouble or to rile anyone up. I am genuinely concerned because people I truly care about are getting drawn into this trap. I worry about the consequences. I'm saying it all in a spirit of love. I'm not looking for a fight. So if you're listening to this series and you disagree with me, all I ask is that you hear me out and look into it in the spirit of a Berean.